For the week of November 16th, 2014, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 258, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York, I'm Michael Giltz.
I've got nothing.
You don't have to have a witty opener of a show, especially when we're being joined by our old friend Karen Woodward.
That's right. On this week's show, we are going to be joined by our old friend and former co-host, Karen Woodward. She has since moved on, and she is now one of Hollywood's more prominent social media marketers. And we're going to be talking to Karen about how Bill Cosby's social media campaign backfired last week after allegations resurfaced that he sexually assaulted a number of women in the past.
Can he press that, you know, erase memory button on Google and get everybody to forget about this?
I don't think so. Not apparently, according to the internet, actually. We also hear from a listener who schools us on how hard it is to open a movie to $100 million. We'll give you a rundown on what's happening in the theater world as we head into the holidays. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines from the past week. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right. And we're looking at book sales around the world, not just in North America. And we pull our information from all sorts of sources. And the number one book around the world is Diary of a Wimpy Kid number 9, The Long Haul. It is the number one English language title around the world. It sold more than 1 million copies on its opening weekend. It sold 320,000 copies in the U.S. alone.
Michael, are you smoking something? No, I am not smoking something,
but we rarely get information on worldwide book sales. And I think it's a harbinger of things to come. Just like we talk about the worldwide box office, I think in the future we may be talking about worldwide book sales. And so that's why I surprisingly started with Diary of a Wimpy Kid. A couple things here. This book sold more than 1 million copies around the world on its opening week. It sold 320,000 copies in the U.S. alone. That means it sold twice as much overseas as it did in North America. What does that sound like, Sperling? The box office, right? The movie box office.
Oh, I didn't know. We're overseas.
It sold 680,000 copies in other countries. Now, we're talking about English language sales. We don't know about books in other languages, but likely this is the number one book worldwide, period. There may be a book in Mandarin or French that sold more, but I don't think so. But these are the figures that we have. And they're talking about English language territories, which is another thing we've talked about on the show, how rights for books will probably not be sold by US and Canada and the UK and France and Germany and Spain and Australia. They'll probably be sold by language rather than physical territory, because with ebooks, it just doesn't make sense to sell books by territory anymore. Not when you can release a book to the world all in one day and make it just as available to everyone else.
Yeah, I'm sorry. You lost me after you told me that the book sold 1 million copies. I've just been practicing my stick figure drawing.
That's right. I thought I couldn't draw, but apparently I could.
Yeah.
Now, I'll tell you, but just as our worldwide box office reveals a lot of stuff we didn't know, I have to say just this one fact about this one book, Diary of a Wimpy Kid, I had no idea the series was popular in other countries. And in fact, it sold twice as much overseas as it did in North America. And Jeff Jacobs, who is with the imprint Amulet Books, that's an imprint of Abrams, he said, quote, "Our strategy of releasing the new book simultaneously in all the English language territories has shown the global power of Jeff's books." That's the author of Diary of a Wimpy Kid.
Or as I like to say, the stick figure artist.
Jeff Kinney, that's correct.
Yes.
And he did a big U.S. tour for it, went to 20 cities, 60 bookstores and schools, spent about a month on the road, and he's going to the U.K. and France in December. So if you're there, look for Jeff Kinney. Obviously, the book is popular all around the world. I didn't know that. Interesting to hear. And I think that's hopefully something that we'll be seeing more and more of down the road, not just isolated titles, but hearing more about actual book sales around the world, not just in North America.
Well, it's very hard to spot Jeff Kinney since he's so thin. You know,
that's right. Yeah. So now back to the worldwide movie box office. Now that we've talked about books, the number one movie around the world, despite being 169 minutes long, is Interstellar, Christopher Nolan's sci-fi movie. It grossed $135 million around the world. It's hit $321 million and counting. $50 million of that has come from IMAX alone. We'll get more on that movie with a really interesting email that we got later on in box office. But let's just get through the rest of the movies first. Okay.
Okay.
All right. And number two around the world is Big Hero 6, another $47 million. This is in 24 territories as opposed to Interstellar, which is in almost three times as many. It's in 64 territories. So Big Hero 6 is a long way to go. It made about $50 million this weekend. It's at $150 million worldwide, doing great so far. At number three, really surprising in North America, doing a lot more money than people expected, is the Jim Carrey, Jeff Daniels comedy Dumb and Dumber 2. Which is actually the third movie in the Dumb and Dumber series. It grossed $47 million, and about $9 million of that came overseas. So everybody loves dumb people. At number four around the world is The Penguins of Madagascar, which opened up early overseas. $11 million that made. That'll be opening up in North America. Is that this weekend?
I think soon? It's soon, actually. I think it's over Thanksgiving weekend. So yeah, maybe.
Two other movies made just about $10 million, Gone Girl and Don't Go Breaking My Heart 2. Gone Girl, of course, is the David Fincher film that hit $320 million worldwide. That's still not there yet, but it's about to become his highest grossing film of all time. And Don't Go Breaking My Heart 2 is a Hong Kong romantic comedy by, of all people, Johnny Toe. Why is that surprising, Sperling? Because Johnny Toe is like an action guy.
Yes.
Right, yeah, so it's very weird.
Well, he's like, yeah, I mean, a big kind of, you know, Yakuza.
Tarantino-esque.
Yeah, exactly.
He makes tough guy gangster films, and here he's got a franchise of romantic comedies. It grossed $9 million this weekend, and yet it's at $24 million total. And I went back last weekend and said, what? I don't remember this movie opening up. Nothing. I don't see it anywhere on our last week's schedule. What's going on, Sperling? How could a movie released in basically China and some Asia have made $15 million between last weekend and this weekend's box office?
Well, didn't it open on the 11s that day, the, you know, 11-11, where it's a big shopping day?
It's Happy Singles Day. That's right.
That's right.
Alibaba, the Chinese website, created a day where people buy stuff for themselves.
That's right.
It's like, buy yourself a gift. I'm all for that. And it's a big shopping day online. And it's also become a big day for movies, especially, I guess, for people who don't want to remain single. You go out on a date to the movies. So Don't Go Breaking My Heart 2 opened on November 11th. And that's where it made $15 million on opening day. In fact, it made $6 million, which I think is a record for Johnny Toe. So that movie in Hong Kong is now at 24, a Hong Kong film, which has opened in six territories, is now at $24 million worldwide.
Can I just say something about that Singles Day? It's on 11-11 in China, right? And the reason we keep hearing about Alibaba and the power of Alibaba as a company and as a business is that on that day, they made $9.8 billion on that one day alone.
They grossed sales that day.
Yes, but
they did not make, right?
Yes, correct. They grossed.
I'm just trying to clarify. And the reason we hear about them is because they had the biggest IPO in history, right?
Well, yes, but think about it this way. North American box office is at $10.4 billion, let's call it.
For an entire year.
For an entire year, an entire industry. They made almost as much money in one day, gross-wise, as the entire North American theatrical box office.
Yeah, way to put it in context. At number seven around the world is Brad Pitt's Fury. That made $7 million. That's at $118 million worldwide and counting. And number eight is Beyond the Lights. This movie opened in North America only. It's a drama, romantic drama about a singer, a rising pop star, and who sort of gets in romantic entanglements and wants to make it big and all the excitement surrounding that. Now, it grossed $6.5 million. It cost $7.2 million to make. So that's a great opening weekend. You know, whenever you can make your budget on opening weekend, that's probably a good sign. And it was directed by Gina Prince-Bythewood, who was the director of Love and Basketball, and it stars Gugu Mbatha-Raw, if I'm saying her first name right, I'm not sure. So I feel like this movie had good reviews, it had a good solid opening, but I felt like they left some money on the table because I think this was a better movie than this. Hopefully it will be good word of mouth and end up stronger, but Gina Prince-Bythewood is a very commercial, very talented director, got good reviews, it's sexy, it's strong. I think it should have opened bigger, and I think they left some money on the table, but we'll have to see where this movie ends up. Did you go see it this weekend, Sperling?
Beyond the Lights?
Yeah, no, you didn't. You probably didn't even know it was opening.
No.
Did you see anything?
Not this weekend, no.
Okay. Well, there were a couple horror films still in there. Ouija and Nightcrawler are still chugging along. Ouija's at $65 million worldwide. Nightcrawler's at $31 million. The Imitation Game, I guess that opened up in the UK. This is a movie about Alan Turing, correct?
Yes.
And the World War II spy breaking, and it's sort of a biopic somewhat of Alan Turing. It's sort of the counterpoint to the Stephen Hawking science film. This is the math film, and it stars Benedict Cumberbatch. It's a Oscar hopeful. It grossed $4.2 million. An opening weekend in a couple territories, and I think it's a solid limited start in the UK where it started. And going far back down, we have a film that opened in Italy. I think just Italy. Yes, it's called La Scuola Più Bella del Mondo, which I think means the best school in the world or the most beautiful school in the world. And it's an Italian comedy that's about apparently this divide between North and South, which I know nothing about. Maybe you do, Sperling, but people in the North are apparently very uptight. And people in the South are very free spirited and hippie like. And a school in the northern Italy, which is the Tuscan region, they have to pair up with a sister school in the wacky Neapolitan southern region, and it's a clash of cultures. It's very hilarious. And then way down towards the bottom, at number 18, is a film that opened up in Germany. It's called Die Mannschaft, which sounds like a bar I almost went to when I first moved to New York, but it's not. It really translates to the team. And it's a movie about the World Cup and about Germany's triumph and its road to the World Cup. So it's like a documentary film like you might see on ESPN. And they cut it together and released it in theaters to celebrate Germany's triumph in the World Cup. I'm almost certain this movie will not open in Brazil.
Now, remember a couple of weeks ago you were talking about, we were talking about that One Direction movie?
Yes, concert. I'd love to know the breakdown of what they get when it's a special event movie, whether it's still the typical 50%. We had lots of questions about that
50%.
Film. It looks like,
yes, it's 50%. Okay. And they spent $300,000 to $500,000. Yeah, $300,000 to $500,000.
That's the budget? Where did you hear that?
I cannot say. I'm not allowed to say.
You're reporting an anonymous source.
An anonymous source, yes. And who basically, well, if I say that, then you'll know. But the distributor walked away with $6 million.
Oh, you mean because it was a $12 million gross?
Well, they made, just the distributor alone, profited $6 million. Profited.
I see. Oh, so that's a different question. So let's compare that to One Direction's last concert film. That's what I was doing. That's One Direction, This Is Us, and that had a budget of $10 million. So it made more money at the box office, and I was worried the one-weekend event sort of limited their upside, and they were leaving money on the table. But if you're looking at a $300,000 to $500,000 budget, well, golly, maybe it was a smart move in the end. Plus, of course, they have a special on NBC happening at Thanksgiving, I think?
Yes. Or is
it Thanksgiving, right? Yeah, so I don't think that's not going to be high-rated.
I don't know.
I don't think so, but you know, more power to them. They're pulling out the stops for the new album. I keep listening to the first track, and I haven't gotten to the rest of the album. All I know is everybody wants to steal their girl.
Okay,
she's great. She's the best. It's a catchy song. I can't get beyond it. So we talked about Interstellar last week. Got in a knockdown, drag-out fight. Even though apparently Sperling agrees with me 100%.
I like the way. Let's start off this argument and this debate by saying that you, sir, agree with me.
A lot of people reached out to us. We got a lot of emails. And a lot of people reached out to us after that episode.
Well, yeah. A lot of people reached out to us after that episode last week, to episode 257. And if you hear at the very beginning, we have this big debate about whether, I guess, Interstellar could have opened to $100 million. At least that's what some people thought the debate was about. I think, Michael, what you were really debating was, no, you can open huge with a three-hour movie. It doesn't matter.
My argument had nothing to do with Interstellar. People said, oh, if this movie were shorter, it would have made more money. And I said, that's not true. And you agree with me. That's not true. The movies make more money based on demand, and a three-hour running time does not hold a movie back from potentially making more money. You just have to have enough screens, etc., blah, blah, blah. But the running time and the language and whether it's color or black and white, all those things have nothing to do with how much a movie makes. Demand is what spurs it. And again, with this industry, we are prepared today better than ever to meet unexpected demand. And the weeks and days coming up to release, we can change things and be prepared and be light on our feet to meet unexpected demand. This movie basically grossed on its opening weekend what was anticipated, the right amount of screens were available for the number of people who wanted to see the movie. It made about what they expected, which was about $50 million. That's what they thought. And that's a lot of money for any movie. And it's going to have a long life. It's got good legs. It's going to be a profitable film. But to say any movie would have made more money if it was shorter is ridiculous. It's like saying if it was 5 minutes long, it would have made $800 million. No, running time does not affect the gross per se, nor does the color of the film or black and white, nor does 3D or 2D, nor does the language it's in. Yes, almost no movies in international languages make a ton of money in the U.S., but it happens. We had an Aramaic film make a lot of money. We've had French films. What matters is the movie. And, of course, all the other variables, when it's released, blah, blah, blah. But the fact is, demand is what drives box office, not the running time. Running time is not a limiting factor that in and of itself prevents a movie from making a lot of money. That's all I was trying to say. And the highest grossing film of all time is Gone with the Wind, which is like 18 hours long.
Right. Okay. But we're talking about opening. Okay. So, yes.
Right. Well, it had a big opening weekend. Well, no, because that's an era where it didn't happen. However, the happy side of this is that it spurred some fascinating emails and information. Go Sperling.
Well, this email is quite long, so I'm not going to read this email. It comes from an anonymous distribution executive for one of the big six studios who, by the way, confirms, he says, anonymous distribution exec who confirms our West Coast sales reps don't work on the lot. So that was one of the things we mentioned last week. So he didn't want to say who he or she was with.
We'll just call him to save the gender problem, but yeah, we don't know.
We don't know what man or woman. 20 years of experience distributing movies into the North American market. And basically, I guess this person, he was taking us to task, schooling us, so to speak, because he was just trying to explain the math to us.
He said listening to us go at it drove him nuts.
Yes.
And he said he can't remember which of you said what, since in my head, one of you is always Cranky Pants and the other one is always Switzerland. Well, to clarify, I'm Cranky Pants, Michael is Cranky Pants, and Sperling is Switzerland. Sperling is the one who always says, well, on the other hand.
You know, I try to take a journalistic approach to it, an objective approach. And in this instance,
but objective does not mean presenting both sides equally. Objective means focusing on the facts, as in global warming. Objective reporting means it's happening. Scientists agree. And there's no scientific debate on global warming. Talking about running time, the objective fact is that running time in and of itself is not a barrier to a movie making a lot of money.
And the keywords there being in and of itself. So, yeah, right. You're right.
Right. And the crux of the whole discussion, he says, revolved around if Interstellar's three-hour running time prevented it from having a $100 million opening. The assumption was that every film opening on more than 3,000 or so screens can gross at that level. That's not what I meant. I thought if there was more demand, it would open on more screens. But anyway, he says, however,
which, by the way, it very well could have. If there was more demand, it may have opened on more screens.
He says, however, with a three-hour running time, the math doesn't pencil, at least not in most situations, not on the number of screens it actually opened on. So hang on tight, and I'll school you both on the matter. Go Sperling!
Okay, so the variables, and I'm trying to summarize since this is a pretty long
yes,
email.
Yes, and come to our show notes because we have it in length and it's fascinating, and the numbers will get confusing if we read them. But if you look at it, it's very easy to track. He explains it very well.
So effectively, and these are broad calculations. So this is a broad forecast. The number of screens, so the number of screens that a film is officially booked on, because what that figure that we quoted, okay, which I think Interstellar opened on 3,561 screens. Those are the official bookings. However, if demand is there, what a theater will do is immediately do what's called an interlock. They will take the film and say, well, we have it booked on two screens, but you know what? Take Gone Girl off screen seven and put, or Ouija off screen seven and put Interstellar on that as well.
And why is it called interlocking?
It's called interlock because during the days of 35 millimeter, you had to lock the print running through both projectors. They both had to be turned on at the same time and be running at the same time, which is why you'd have two theaters going that started at roughly the same time. They might be like 2 or 3 minutes apart or 5 minutes apart. But for the most part, they ran together.
And you would literally, this was in the old days where if you went into the booth, you would literally see the film going from one machine shooting the image into one theater across like the aisle to another machine that was shooting it into another theater, right? I mean, it was physically, machines, they were attached.
You mean projectors, but yes.
Projectors, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, they were, and that's why, like, say, at the AMC 25 there on 42nd Street, Michael, it's very difficult to do interlocks because the theaters are on different floors. It's like 9 or 10 stories, so you can't interlock screen 25 on floor 8 with
digitally?
Well, digitally, it's a virtual interlock, and so it's a lot easier.
Right, because today they're not physical prints.
Right.
Not at the AMC 25.
So you might get, like, you know, a movie like Toy Story 3, which opened on 4,028 screens. It probably played on close to 5,000 screens.
So give us this formula.
So the formula is the number of officially booked screens times the average seats per screen. Okay, so that's kind of between 150 and 200. The industry kind of picks like 170 as the average seats per screen. So it's number of screens booked times the average seats per screen times the average number of shows per screen. And there's where that running time thing comes into play, because mm-hmm. it's either 3 if it's, or 3.5 if it's 3 hours long, or it's 5, sometimes 6 if it's a 1.5 hour movie. So again, you can see where the math starts to play a part. Times the average ticket price times 3 days. So all of those variables, all of those numbers can give you kind of an overview or a forecast of how much a film is capable of potentially making.
Once you know how many screens they've officially limited it to, my point would always be in the days and weeks leading up to a release, if there's massive demand, they're going to put it on more screens.
That's right.
So my point is not that this movie was released on 3,500 screens and therefore I'm foolish to suggest it would have made more money. Its actual total capacity was about $65 million using this formula, correct?
Yeah, between $65 and $72 million.
Right. That was the absolute maximum it could have made technically if we'd limit it to the official number of screens, estimating the number of seats, estimating the number of shows per day, which of course are limited based on the hours in a day and how many times you're going to show a movie. But, you know, that's the capacity once we are locked into that particular number. And so, of course, this movie had a capacity of up to $75 million and it grossed $50 million, which means there probably was not a lot of money left on the table. There weren't a lot of people who showed up at the theater and said, I want to see this movie, and couldn't find a showtime they were willing to go to.
Correct.
Okay. But
right, the actual per screen average should have been above $17,000, almost $18,000 per screen. It was, however, $13,342 per screen, which means it was below average, which means the demand wasn't there.
Right. So now the geeky thing that you can do is look at a movie, thanks to his formula and the information he provides, he or she, and see what a movie, how many screens it was on, its official thing, look at it, the per screen average, and you can spot when a movie has been interlocked and shown a lot of extra screens. When the official screen capacity is one thing, but the actual number is higher because the per screen average is so high, you're actually grossing 130% of your potential. Right.
Right. Correct.
And so if you look at a movie, wait a second. This, yeah.
But look at Avengers or Iron Man 3, and you go, wait a second. This does not. I mean, how
could? Are people sitting in other people's laps? How could it make $38,000 per screen? It doesn't make sense.
Right.
Okay, that's fascinating.
And there's also, you know, a movie like Toy Story or Big Hero 6 skews lower a little bit because of all the matinee showings. However, then there's 3D to take into account and IMAX to take into account. And some people only want to see it in IMAX, so they'll wait. And so there's, again, as you say, one of the many factors that you have to consider is running time, but it doesn't necessarily limit you to earning under $100 million.
He says either way, running time does play a factor because it lowers the average shows per screen. And if you're only on 3,500 screens like Interstellar, that makes troublesome math. That makes trouble math-wise. Just look at Avatar, the most anticipated film in the last 5 years, which only, in quotes, opened to $77 million on roughly that number of screens, with a per screen average $9,000 higher than Interstellar, thanks to 3D prices. The Hobbit movies also suffer from the average number of show times. The thing with all these movies, however, is that they play out well. Opening weekend for these titles was 29% of their gross. And when you look at Hunger Games or Harry Potter, it's more like 39%. So those films flame out faster. Hope all this was understandable and helps a little. Otherwise, I love the show. We've really reduced the amount of information you provided. It's fascinating to go through it and bit by bit. So if you're not an anonymous distribution exec who already knows this, it really would behoove you to like take the time and look at his email that we've got in the show notes right under box office, because it is fascinating. But as he says, once you're on 3,500 screens, my point is that, well, yeah, but if there was more demand, you would have been on more than 3,500 screens.
Right. And, you know, there's also some discussion in the industry of, are those numbers accurate? You know, because a lot of times directors will say, I can't believe you opened Steven Spielberg's movie on 3,500 screens and you didn't open mine. Spielberg's a hack. He's a has-been. And I'm a Michael Bay, or insert name of big-time director now. And I should be on 3,700 screens. And so there's always the reported openings are always some question as to whether they're goosed. It's a lot easier now with the internet to actually track that down and track how many screens a film is playing on.
So his point is, once you know the number of screens you're on, you can look at the screen average to see what demand was based on those screens. You can look at all sorts of things and factor out what its potential maximum gross was officially.
Roughly,
and see where it ended up and see whether there was money left on the table. But I mean, the classic example of a movie where Hollywood was blindsided and had no idea what was going on, had no idea people were going to flock to the film in the way they did, that took place 4 years ago, didn't it, Sperling?
Yeah, 2010 in March, Alice in Wonderland. Now, this was 5 months or 4 months after...
It was 12 weeks after Avatar. 3 months, barely. Less than 3 months Avatar opened up.
Yeah. Right. 3D was fresh and new. You had Tim Burton, a big artistic director with the, you know...
Johnny Depp.
Yeah. Most likely this is going to be, you know, another 3D spectacle. So everybody turned out and wanted to see the film in 3D. And the 3D bump on that film took it from an expected between $75 and $80 million to $116 million in its opening weekend.
In other words, it outperformed its tracking. People expected it to make $80 million. It made $116 million. It was a huge out-of-left-field hit. But my point would
be... And this was, by the way, at a time when digital cinema had not been, you know, most films were still being shown 35 millimeter.
Absolutely. So, but my point is that even when you're blindsided, they were able to scramble and provide capacity so that even if money was left on the table, they got it to $116 million.
It was successful.
It was massively successful. So, you know, yes, if Interstellar had had more unexpected demand and something had exploded in the last few weeks of excitement before it opened, they would have scrambled and made more screens available and done what they could. And they would have met demand, you know, as anticipated. Maybe money would have been left on the table, but they would have, you know, they would have done what they could. And this movie would have made a lot more money. The reason it made $50 million was because that's how many people wanted to go there on opening weekend to see this particular film. If there'd been more demand, there would have been more capacity, and therefore would have made more, right?
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. But there is one thing holding this movie back that we have not discussed. There's one factor that, in fact, is limiting. Unlike whether it's in color and black and white, 3D, 2D, who stars in it, is it a sequel, who's the director, what time of year, what are the movies open, all those things, you know, affect demand. But technically, a movie can make as much money as possible. None of those things limit it as such, other than the fact, do they want to see the movie? That's what really limits it. But there is one factor with Interstellar that has kept it, perhaps, from making as much money, because they cannot meet the demand for this particular way. What is that?
Wait, I'm sorry. Could you repeat that, Michael? Because I didn't hear you. Can you say that one more time?
Really?
That was a joke. Because, of course.
No, that's not what I was talking about. You're talking about sound.
Yes, I was talking about sound, because apparently some theater owners have reported there have been complaints. Patrons are coming out saying, look, I can't understand the dialogue. Some of the key crucial dialogue that at least they think it's key and crucial. I can't hear it. Can you like fix the sound? Your sound is broken. And no,
they're like, that's the way Christopher Nolan wants it.
Right. And so they've actually posted at Cinemark in some theaters. They've posted signs saying, yes, the music is loud. Yes, the sound effects are loud in certain parts. There's a reason for that. That's the way Christopher Nolan mixed the film. And there, Carolyn Giardina had a whole interview with Christopher Nolan in The Hollywood Reporter that in which he kind of goes into detail about how and why he mixed the film.
And yeah, that's what he wanted. When they're driving through a cornfield early in the movie, he said he did it in real life. It's really noisy and explosive and exciting. And so he wanted that excitement. Oh, you know, corn slapping your car while you're yelling at each other trying to hear. And he recreated that sense, and literally you can't hear what they're saying sometimes. That's nice. That's exciting. I would buy it more if I hadn't seen The Dark Knight Rises and had the villain Bane be incomprehensible for most of the film there as well. Do you want your villain to literally be incomprehensible?
Well, you know,
I mean, I don't know why he's got such an exciting yen for making dialogue incomprehensible for much of the film, but, you know, knock yourself out.
Well, you mentioned The Dark Knight Rises. He showed 8 minutes of that film, the first opening 8 minutes. And in that film, Bane was, in that kind of like, yeah, you couldn't understand a word he was saying. And a lot of audiences said that. So Warner Brothers kind of forced the issue, and he went back and remixed it so that you could understand Bane.
I saw the movie in theaters, and I could not understand Bane most of the time. He didn't fix it. Maybe in the beginning scenes, he made it a little more comprehensible so people would relax, but that was still extremely muddy. It was ridiculous. I watched the movie. I'm like, what? What did he say?
Yeah.
I'm not old. I couldn't hear what he was saying. But my factor on Interstellar, which is, I think, a valid point, unlike running time, unlike what color it's shot in, unlike everything else, or none of those limited its box office. What does limit its box office is IMAX.
Well, yes, because if you want to see it in IMAX, on a big IMAX screen, and, you know,
so many screens available.
Yes, and some of those screens don't have a lot of seats, and so you may have to wait a couple of weeks to actually go see the film in a theater, in a traditional IMAX 70mm theater.
Or even FOMAX, even if you want to see it that way, in FIMAX, if you want to see it in the fake IMAX screens. There aren't that many of those. There just aren't that many IMAX-branded screens. Certainly the number of screens that are actual, legitimate IMAX screens, that's really limited, isn't it?
Yes.
So, I mean, yeah, there's no way to meet the demand. Maybe everybody who wanted to see this movie would have preferred to see it in IMAX. That was literally not possible. It's just like if a movie opens on two screens in New York, you know, you're not going to necessarily meet demand, you know, because you're only on two screens. And if it's a big anticipated movie, it will be jammed full. And that's where you get 100,000 per screen average. And people are still turned away. That is not the case with the wide release of Interstellar in most formats. But yes, in IMAX, there may have been extra demand that could not be met by the limited number of screens that are available to show this movie in IMAX. So that is a distributing factor. That is a limiting factor. And that could be one reason why there was perhaps more demand to see it that way than they could meet.
Yes, that's true.
But it's not true to say that any movie would make more money if it was shorter. That's never true. I mean, we're not talking, obviously, about a 10-hour film. But basically, you know, if you say a movie was 3 hours long, oh, I would have made more money if it was 100 minutes. Well, no, it would be a completely different film. And maybe there'd be less demand because people say, well, it's not an event. If I'm going to go see Titanic, I want to sink into the luxuriousness of this event, epic event. And I want to feel like it's a big deal. So shortening the running time does not increase ticket sales per se. It makes it a different movie. And therefore, it may increase or decrease demand or have no effect whatsoever. But the actual running time, in most cases, talking about normal films, 3 hours or less, is not a limiting factor.
Say big deal? I think you just said big deal.
Oh my God, did I really?
In fact, you did, which means it must be time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, boy, we have been waiting to report this one. Amazon blinked first. Sort of. The website Behemoth and the publisher Hachette have reached an agreement after a long-running dispute that made front-page news. The key element? Hachette gets to set prices on ebooks. Amazon wanted a bigger share of ebook revenue and wanted Hachette to lower prices. Sell your books for less and give us more of the profits. That was their demand. Hachette demurred. However, others say it's similar in nature to the deal Amazon made with Simon & Schuster without all this ugly public battling back and forth. Whether that deal was possible because of Hachette's resistance or whether Hachette ended up caving in is hard to tell until more details are forthcoming. Big deal or big whoop?
Again, we don't know. I think it's a big deal. Everybody seems to have a different opinion. Some people say, it's great for publishing. Other people say, damn it, Hachette lost the ability to really put them to the fire and change the way business is done. You know, so I think the jury is out. I think it's clear it's good for Hachette authors that their books will slowly start to get back online and be available on a speedy basis via Amazon because they are the biggest online and offline source for books in the country, in North America. And, I think Really? Got to get rid of digital rights management. Stop limiting books to just the device you buy them on. Don't make it hard for people to buy books from other places. Right now, they're tying the hands of consumers. If you buy a book from Amazon and put it on your Kindle, it's very hard to switch over to a Nook or an iPad or something else. Why make it hard for people to go between device and device? You're just killing yourself with the DRM. I think that's the next step that they got to do to try and loosen the grip of Amazon on consumers if they think that's a good idea.
Well, right now, Apple is facing the very same lawsuit for the iPod and iTunes. So
iPod?
Yes. And yes, it's a very old case. And everybody says, well, gee, what's the point? You know, the iPods barely exist anymore. And oh,
they discontinued them, didn't they, practically?
Yes, they did. And so, you know, but it's a 2005 or 2006 case about how, you know, it was an antitrust case.
And there's a DRM thing?
Yeah, DRM thing that you can only buy songs from iTunes.
And they've got rid of DRM, so I'm surprised it's still a valid case. Or I guess it's past losses or something?
Past losses, and, you know, they're basically saying, well, it forced consumers to buy iPods.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, but, you know, at some point this will be an issue. You're absolutely right.
Yeah, they've got it's only hurting the publishers. They think they need it to fight piracy, but in fact, they're just making it hard for people to access books from a lot of different suppliers. They lock you in to Barnes & Noble or Amazon or Kobo or whoever it is.
Well, you know what else was inevitable at some point? When we've been talking about it for what seems like months, YouTube is finally launching its paid music service. It's called Music Key because Google Play was not enough. It lets you schedule videos to watch or listen to while offline and also groups music much more sensibly. You can literally find an entire album's worth of music from an artist offered in order, assuming there's a video of some sort for the official music. And increasingly, there is. It also offers fan-created videos with new footage and or their own performances in the mix, though obviously, the more successful so-called cover bands get better placement, and the real artists get the best placement of all. It's in beta mode right now, and will go out to everyone 2015 for about $10 a month. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, gosh, I guess it's a big deal. I mean, YouTube is letting people play their app in the background while using other apps. That was something you couldn't do before. And the traditional YouTube site gets a billion unique visitors a month. So obviously they have a huge captive audience and they want to make it a more official service. They want to monetize it by making it better and more useful and, you know, making it a more seamless, you know, source of music listening. Whether it's going to work, I don't think we'll know until we start to play with it.
Oh, speaking of playing, actually, professional video game players have existed for years, but they were usually testers who played around with beta versions of video games to spot flaws, give feedback and the like, but the New York Times just profiled 22-year-old Matt Hogg, who quit his job flipping burgers at McDonald's for the far better job of playing the video game Call of Duty for a living. Hogg makes more than $1 million a year, in no small point to the 1.5 million YouTube subscribers who follow him. His daily training sessions are licensed, which is like having people pay to watch Roger Federer's every drill on the tennis court, I suppose. I don't know. He's got trainers and nutritionists and travelers. He travels the world to play in all these tournaments. People fill stadiums to watch him play in person. You know what? I'm in the wrong profession, Michael. At home in Chicago, fans are becoming a problem at his house. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal, partially because it's all social media. That's why we're going to have Karen Woodward on the show in Inside Baseball to talk about how powerful social media is right now and how you got to be careful because it can backfire. But this is interesting. This story, this guy, and what's going on, and people going to watch him play. If you're under 30, it's like a no-brainer. It makes complete sense. If you're over 30, people are like, what? They watch someone play video games? They cannot comprehend. I'm like, well, didn't you ever sit there when you were a kid and watch someone do tech? Well, yeah, I guess. But, you know, like they can't get it. They cannot grasp their mind of watching somebody perform and play and compete in a multiplayer video game. They literally do not get it. They think you're making it up.
I actually go to the movies and watch people play video games all the time. I think the last one was called Transformers 4 or 5 or whatever they're up to. Sony is launching an over-the-top bundled TV service via its PlayStation machines. It's a cross between cable and Netflix, with PlayStation View offering some 75 branded channels, including some local stations and channels like CBS, Fox, NBC, Comedy Central, MTV, Nickelodeon, Discovery, Animal Planet, Oxygen Sci-Fi, Food Network, and, you know, a whole lot more. You won't find, though, ABC, Disney, AMC, HBO, or ESPN, just to name a few. It starts in New York City and will add other cities in 2015. There's no contract, just a monthly fee. Wait a second. Is this story even real? Once you select a show, you have 1 month to watch it, with no limit to how many shows you can, quote-unquote, set aside for viewing. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. Again, I think you and I are on the same page as far as people say, I want to cut the cord. But it's going to get very frustrating when you realize how many channels you actually, you know, want to have access to. Not because most people probably watch 10 or 15 channels at the most, but then something new comes up and you want to watch the Food Channel, or you want to watch ESPN, or you want to watch, you know, Nickelodeon. So all these different services that have lots of, you know, segments of what you want. It's not going to be satisfying. I don't know until somebody can offer basically cable. And then you're going to say, well, God, it costs a lot. Well, yeah, because it costs a lot. So I'm not sure how it's all going to fall out. But, you know, $10 here, $10 there, it's going to add up pretty damn quickly, isn't it?
You know what you could do? Subscribe to SiriusXM and you can listen to them. You know, it's the satellite radio here in North America. And it's getting a little bit interesting over there at SiriusXM. Nationwide copyright for sound recordings, you know, songs, popular music. That began in 1972. Many, many radio stations and venues like restaurants and arenas have in practice assumed they were free to play music released before 1972, which is why you hear the Beatles so much. And they assumed they could do that over the air without payment for the use of the recording. We should note they've always paid money to songwriters, however. The 1960s group, the Turtles, said, wait, not so fast. They've sued the satellite company SiriusXM in California, and they won. Under state law, however. Now they've sued and won in New York State as well. The Turtles want a lot of money. SiriusXM wants to appeal, since actual sales of sound recordings are falling, but the playing of them via radio and streaming services is growing. This could have a huge implication down the road. Big deal or big whoop, Michael? Or did I just answer my own question?
You just answered your own question. It's a big deal. Yeah. I mean, we don't know where it's going to fall out. It's on the road to being, decided. They're going to probably have to appeal to Congress to straighten it all out. I don't think it's going to happen in courts because there's going to have to be some big new legislation, I think, to deal with this because it's going to impact so many different groups and people with so much money at stake that, it's a mess. It's a mess.
Well, and everybody said, look, if these rulings are negative, if they lose these cases, then whatever, you know, it's nothing changes. But these are federal copyright laws, okay? There's federal copyright laws. You can't have, I mean, these are conflicting federal and state.
Well, that's why you've got the courts, that's why you've got the courts, and you've got legislators. You know, if you either resolve it in a higher court where they resolve them or create new law, or you got to go back to the legislature and say we need new rules.
Or if you're the Turtles, you go state by state suing SiriusXM in every single state, which is kind of annoying.
And you remain happy together.
Yes, very funny. Google Turtles and find out what song they sing. It's going to have those two words in it. Michael asked for it, and Michael got it, though.
Yes!
We're talking about the Book Expo of America, or BEA. It's the biggest annual gathering of the publishing industry in North America. Agents, editors, writers, independent store owners, librarians, distributors, people who design covers, people who design warehouses, Michael Giltz. You know,
that's right.
People like that. They all come together once a year at the BEA. In the last few years, they also tacked on BookCon. Their attempts to do for books what Comic-Con did for comics. Michael said they were both great events, but didn't really belong together. And everyone listened. The BEA will take place May 27th through May 29th, and BookCon will take place May 30th through 31st at the Javits Center in New York City. Wait, isn't that... Yeah, that's exactly what they did the last time, isn't it? Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop in a way. I mean, we're not sure how it's going to fall out and what they're doing. They've acknowledged, yes, these are separate events. So how it's going to impact the industry people versus what they do the next 2 days for the public, it's not clear yet. Who's going to be there? Will they have a presence? Will they have their booths? Will they tear it all down and do something else? They have not figured it out yet. So I think they should be at separate times of the year. I mean, I think they should be really separate because they get a lot of press for the BEA, and I think they can get a lot of press for BookCon and piggyback on movies and TV shows. So I think there's a lot of potential in BookCon, but it's never going to really flourish until they move it to a separate time and really make it its own big event, because it's this whole separate beast. And they've started to do that by saying, yeah, they are separate. We're going to make them sort of separate, but they haven't really bit the bullet yet. That's going to come, and it'll be a success when they do.
Well, Michael, that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop and brings us to the moment you've been waiting for, Michael. I know you especially have been waiting for this because it's time for Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And, Michael, the reason you've been waiting for this, of course, is because we are welcoming Karen Woodward back to the show.
Hey, welcome, Karen.
Yay. Hey, guys.
For longtime listeners, of course, you'll know that Karen Woodward was once one of our co-hosts, and she went off to become way more successful than all of us as a social media... I don't know, what do you call yourself? I mean, what is... You're like one of the go-to people in Hollywood for social media. So what does that mean exactly?
Well, they call me a consultant, which can mean anything. I don't know if you'd call me the go-to person in Hollywood, but I like that. I like that description.
Well, I mean, who are some of your clients? Please name them by and spell their names as well.
You know I'm not going to do that.
So she's apparently discreet.
So you help people with their social media lives and specific social media campaigns, right?
Correct. Right.
All
and
right.
I work for one major company that I'm not going to say, but if anybody investigated me, you know what it was. And I've done some work on some movies, and I've worked with some celebrities, not huge celebrities, but minor celebrities, and that kind of thing. Yeah.
And you've talked about how busy you are before we came on the air. You said, I'm really busy, a lot of work. And that just points to the fact that social media, I mean, TV shows, people get roles on TV shows and get late night talk shows and get this and that because of how many Twitter followers they have. And social media is where, the New York Times profiled a kid who's making money as a video game player. But in fact, he's making his money because of his social media following. He's really making his money on YouTube because people subscribe to watch him practice, not because he's making money at tournaments as such. Social media has really infiltrated a lot of areas and it drives up people's perceived value and actual value, doesn't it?
It does. And YouTube itself is a growing area for the millennial generation and younger than that. I mean, that's really going to be the next frontier for quote unquote TV, which is really just video these days.
Well, yeah. You know, that's because millennials don't read.
Millennials don't read. They only watch video. The shorter, the better.
They read and watch videos, but I'm eating a Jell-O Pop, Sperling. Why don't you explain why that is?
Okay, and this is the reason we wanted to speak with Karen, among many others, of course, Karen, was that about a month ago, a stand-up comic named Hannibal Buress kind of ripped into Bill Cosby, the comedian and, you know, the Cosby Show guy, calling him a serial rapist while doing a show in Philadelphia, which is Bill Cosby's hometown. It's where he lives. It made national news that this comedian did this because somebody videotaped it. So that's what's remarkable to me. In 1980, this comedian would have said this on stage. 800 people would have seen it, and that would have been the end of it. But now...
He got posted online and got a lot of hits.
Yeah, and now all of these allegations that Bill Cosby sexually assaulted, you know, upwards of 13 women have kind of come back around. These aren't new allegations, and they are allegations. They've never been proven. And in the midst of all of this, Bill Cosby and his handlers, whoever they may be, decided that for this new Netflix show that he's doing, a comedy special, they were going to generate some buzz, some online buzz. And so they did this social media campaign called Meme Me, and it totally backfired. Now, Karen, what is a meme?
Well, a meme is... It is originally really just a fad. That is kind of what it really started off as. Like Grumpy Cat would be a really good example of that, taking Grumpy Cat and then putting across the top of it text. Usually it's funny or ironic or you know, something like that. I mean, these days, it's just kind of come to mean any kind of image whatsoever that lives on social. But in terms of the Bill Cosby story, it has to do with taking an image and putting text on top of it.
And so what happened when Bill Cosby's social media campaign tried to do this?
Well, this backfired in a major way. So I think they used Meme Generator, and it looks like they provided maybe 5 images of him and encouraged people to meme me. So in other words, put text on top of these images.
Have fun.
They clearly were expecting people to like use some of those famous quotes or, you know, to be very pro Bill Cosby. But instead what happened was that they put text on top of it saying something like, I'm a racist, tipping my hat to that, or, you know, anything like that. And it was, it's exactly what, as a social media manager, you do not want to happen. It's the definition of a backfire.
So now what we're talking about is there have been allegations throughout his career, actually. It's not the first time, but the biggest issue is that in 2006, Bill Cosby was headed to a civil trial with a woman who claimed he sexually assaulted her. And at the time, her lawyer said 13 other women were ready to take the stand, making similar allegations to Bill Cosby. One of those women who was ready to testify was Barbara Bowman, who alleges that he drugged and raped her repeatedly over a 2-year period beginning when she was 17 years old. She said she never went to the cops because first she rationalized it, then thought it was the price to pay to get ahead in Hollywood, and then realized others wouldn't take her seriously and she felt she'd have no success if she tried to make her case. She's now become an advocate for rape victims. And while this was all going on, she wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post about her experience when this meme exploded in Bill Cosby's face. So, you know, what happened was this guy in Philly went on, you know, stage and said, Bill Cosby's a rapist. Then Bill Cosby was uninvited from the Queen Latifah show because either the show or he did not want to deal with the allegations that were bubbling up on social media. Then in the midst of this, he has a special coming up on Netflix, just like you used to have a big special on HBO. And his people said, well, you know, some guy in Philly did something, whatever. We've got a show to promote. And they came up with this social media thing, and that blew up in their face. Now he's had to cancel from David Letterman, or Letterman's, you know, they don't want to go on Letterman and have to deal with these questions. So he's canceled Letterman. He's canceled Queen Latifah. He's trying to promote this special, and he doesn't know how to do it. You know, did his people do anything wrong? Should they have known, because this video had 100,000 hits on YouTube, that it was not a good time to try a social media campaign? I mean, you know, I can see how they'd be blindsided by what happened.
Well, Bissy, I don't. And it has less to do with just that video having gone viral, which obviously they should have been a big tip-off to them that these allegations against Bill Cosby were still very fresh in people's minds. But when you manage the social media presence of a brand or a celebrity who has something like that in their past or is hated on some level, your job is to know that there are certain things you cannot do, and Meme Generator is definitely one of them. Never in a million years would I allow that to get past the idea stage, because your job as a social media manager is to think 5 steps ahead. So my first thought would be, how can this go wrong? And it's going to lead you to exactly what did go wrong. So clearly, and I have no idea who or what agency was behind this idea, so I don't want to badmouth them, even though I am. but that's exactly what, this is an example of somebody saying, wouldn't this be a fun idea? And everyone's saying, yeah, it's great. But nobody taking the other side and saying, this can go horribly wrong.
Well, let me ask you,
that's how this happened.
Well, if you look at even the video in which the comedian in Philadelphia is referring to this, he kind of admits, and this is Hannibal Buress, he kind of admits, look, go home and Google Bill Cosby and the word rape, and you'll get more hits than my own name. And I did not know about these allegations so much, and I think the you know, Hannibal Buress realized that most people don't know about these allegations, or at least they weren't, you know, that they're not the first thing you think of when you bring up the name Bill Cosby. So do you think maybe the social media managers here either A, didn't know themselves, or B, didn't think any, you know, it was a really big problem.
Let me add an adjunct to that. I don't think his Kubrick, I don't think he's was Mel Gibson in their eyes, that he was a guy with a big looming problem. I mean, these were old allegations and that they had been come up years ago. And obviously we take it seriously, but there was no bubbling new controversy around it. He'd never been convicted of anything. He had admitted to having extramarital affairs, and the woman that he did claimed he'd fathered her child, but she refused to get a DNA test, and then her daughter was jailed for trying to extort him for $40 million. So over his career, he's had allegations of being a womanizer and from people who were not of good character necessarily. So, you know, this wasn't something that was a really ugly negative part. I doubt his Q ratings were bad. And I don't think this is a question of like he had a really bad reputation and they should have been smart about that. I think it's more an example of people using social media to get their message out that hadn't penetrated yet. If he's going to have a bad reputation, it will be more because of how they use social media to hijack his campaign rather than something they should have anticipated in advance.
I'm going to disagree with you on that. I think that if you are doing the social media for a celebrity of that caliber, your job is to know everything about them. So if they give the excuse that they didn't know about the allegations, then that's just ignorance.
I think it was old news that hadn't made any headlines in many, many years. It's been.
I don't care. That's still your job as a social media manager to know.
Oh, they would know, yeah.
When you have a user-generated campaign, you have to think about everything that could go wrong. And it seems pretty obvious to me that they didn't, because this would have been the first thing that would have come up.
Mm-hmm. And so how do you manage the spin from this? I guess there's no managing it. It's done.
Yeah, no, it's done.
And so you never do a campaign where you have user-generated elements.
I would never do that for Bill Cosby. I would never do that for any celebrity or brand that has that could possibly go wrong like that.
So never for Miley Cyrus, never for, is it just too dangerous that there's no point in doing it in general because it's just too many open risks?
No, I don't think so. I do think it's heading in that direction, yes, but right now, no. But can you go back to your Mel Gibson example? He's a celebrity that I would know, not in a million years, because what he did was so awful and was so polarizing that you are going to get people on social media that are going to hijack that campaign. Miley Cyrus, what are people going to do? They're going to, make fun of her for being a tart? I mean, who cares? It's not like she's done something, you know, really egregious.
Yeah, she's got her own racy image, and therefore Kim Kardashian can't be made fun of because she flourishes with attention.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. But neither one of them has done anything that's so polarizing. I mean, people might hate them, but it's only because they're douchebags, not because, you know, they're anti-Semitic or rapists. That's a different level that we're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Well, so then what social media campaigns, either the ones that you've worked on or ones that, recent ones, kind of went right? The opposite of what happened with Bill Cosby, where you didn't see that coming, but it was in a good way.
No, I liked Oreo Cookies campaign when they were just plugging the Oreo into pop culture moments. I thought that was really, very clever. I'm not a big fan of Dunk in the Dark. I mean, obviously it was clever and people were talking about it and that's a great thing. I'm not really sure what it did for Oreos if they got us talking about it. I'm not sure it made me run out and buy more Oreos, but I liked their general pop culture campaign much better.
Right. It's sort of the equivalent of a TV commercial where it may be a really fun, entertaining commercial, but you don't remember what they're selling. And therefore,
exactly. Okay,
you had fun making it and they had fun watching it, but you're not actually selling potato chips.
Yeah, it was really a much better ad for the agency behind it.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
These days, a lot of the ads are.
Yeah, they are, especially the Super Bowl ads.
Yes, exactly. They're more for, you know, gray advertising and all the agency, as you say, the agencies and the production companies behind them.
Well, Bill Cosby has 4 million followers on Twitter. And obviously, everybody has a presence on Facebook and Twitter and the right people on Pinterest and so on. It's got to be harder and harder to, you know, you have to have a presence on social media, but it's harder to leverage that into something really big because everybody else is there as well, isn't it? So what are the trends in social media or what are the ways that you have to have a presence, but how do you smartly make use of it in the right way or break through, or what's the new platform that people are excited by?
Instagram is the next one. A lot of celebrities like Instagram because they don't have to actually talk. All they really have to do is take a picture. And a lot of celebrities go to cool events, so they're on a set, so it makes that kind of easy. I think if you're a celebrity on social, I think that what you need to do is to think about what it is about yourself that you're willing to share. Is that your person, that your sense of humor? Is that places that you go? Is it your politics? And you need to focus on that. A good example is Anna Kendrick is very funny on social media. And it's not something that always translates into her movies. Not to say she's not funny. She is. I mean, she's hilarious and Pitch Perfect. She does a lot of dramas, too. Another good one is I like Stephen Amell from Arrow. He does
Which
a lot
character
of set stuff. And he is Arrow. What do you mean?
Oh, okay. I've forgotten his name.
Please, are you kidding me? With that body, how could you not know who Stephen Amell was? But for Bill Cosby, I would have stuck to the fact that he's an icon, and I probably would have done a Twitter chat with him. That's kind of the new thing if you do a Twitter chat. I just did one for one of my clients that went.
Can you control the questions?
Well. Yeah.
So they don't see the bad questions?
What you do is you ask people to ask questions and you include a hashtag. So in this case, it would be like probably Ask Bill or Ask Bill Cosby or Ask Cosby or something. And yes, anybody who's following that hashtag would be able to see what people were asking. So it could conceivably have been hashtag like, why'd you rape that girl? But he only has to respond to the ones that he wants to respond to.
Mm-hmm. So it's not like a live chat where you're going to see new questions pop up and be like, oh.
Well, yeah, well, the whole world would only see them if they were following the hashtag, which they could be. And that could be hijacked. I mean, I always hesitate to do anything if I'm working with a brand that's not loved. I always hesitate to do anything that's user-generated because there's always that possibility that it's going to be hijacked. But Bill Cosby, he's got 4 million followers, as you said. He doesn't have to do anything that's user-generated. He's Bill Cosby, and he's on Netflix.
Right.
They didn't need to do anything, and I probably wouldn't have risked it.
Well, I'm sure right now there is somebody in a marketing group that is brushing up their resume.
Or they wishing they'd hired you.
Nah. I'm the best kept secret in Hollywood.
You talked about Anna Kendrick as being a great example, but she's doing that herself probably. And I think your number one recommendation to celebrities is to probably not do it yourself.
You know, it's funny because I would say that if you're not going to do it yourself, don't be on Twitter because it's really obvious to me when an agency is doing it. And there are certain people I know that do it for celebrities and do it really, really well. But they have to know the celebrity well. They have to only have, you know, maybe 1 to 5 that they do it for so they can be really close to them. It's really obvious to me when an agency does it. I think in this case with Bill Cosby, it was obviously an agency's mistake. And I think you run into a lot of trouble when you have an agency taking over the presence of a person. Because you're really only going to be, to me, interesting on Twitter if you are doing it yourself. Which means that you shouldn't be on Twitter doing it yourself if you don't have somebody who's going to talk you through what you should and shouldn't do.
And that's when people can call you.
Yeah, I mean, that's actually what I, at some point, want to only do, is to help celebrities with their presence on Twitter. A lot of them know that they need to be there, but they're too shy, or they don't know the basic best practices, and they don't know best practices for, you know, their own quote-unquote brand. That is a really interesting space, and it's definitely a growing one for celebrities.
You know, somebody I've noticed who does it incredibly well is Elizabeth Banks, the actress.
Oh, I've never seen it.
She goes out to a red carpet. She has a picture taken of her in her dress, her shoes, her makeup, getting made up. And she creates a little like, you know,
fashion show.
Yeah, like a little collage. And then, yeah, it's unbelievable. She's really good at it.
Yeah, no, it's funny because it's celebrities of that kind of caliber that tend to be really, really good in it because they don't have to worry about like their brand. They're not a brand. They're building their brand on social. Another person who does it really well right now is Rachel Melvin. She plays the daughter slash love interest in Dumb and Dumber 2, which just came out.
And had a big hit.
She's hilarious. Yeah, big hit. She's hilarious on it. She's she always tags, you know, the right people. She uses the right hashtags. She tells people, you know, what it was like to be somewhere, you know, at an interview or whatever. She promotes her own blog that she has. And it's a really good example of how somebody who is in, like, an up-and-comer can use social media to get people to know them better. And I think that when people get to know them better and their fan base gets larger, to your point, what you were saying at the very beginning, you are more likely to get roles, get talk show appearances, and that kind of thing. And it's an interesting way that social media is playing in how actors get roles.
Well, you know, then there are veteran actors like Jack Nicholson, where there's only one tweet. You can't handle the tweet.
Kudos to him. You want to grab your
okay,
own.
Okay, I made that up. I made that up.
Oh, really?
I was, yeah.
I think that every single celebrity should grab their own handle right now, whether they're going to do it or not, just to make sure that nobody else takes their handle. And if they're not on Twitter, they should have their own Twitter handle, and it should say, you know, who they are and that I am not on Twitter. Even better if Twitter would verify them so that people know, you know, who they are. Because one of the reasons why celebrities are advised, or any brand is advised, to get on social is because everybody else is. They're all talking about you. You might as well join the conversation. But there are a lot of celebrities who don't want to join the conversation, and I get that. But you should still stake your claim.
Buy your website, own your Twitter name,
exactly.
Own your Facebook page, exactly. Make it a thing, yeah.
Well, before we end this conversation, here's my question for you, Karen. Exactly how do I get more Twitter followers again?
Advertising. All advertising.
Are you serious?
Oh, yeah. Well, and to be on Twitter a lot. Follow people. Follow people, use hashtags, and just be in there.
I don't even know how to use hashtags.
Oh, it's so easy. Whatever you're talking about, use that hashtag for it. So when you're promoting this podcast, make sure to use the hashtag Bill Cosby.
Oh, okay. We've never used
but
hashtags.
If Jimmy Fallon and Justin Timberlake are making fun of hashtags, isn't it time to move beyond?
But there's no other way to search, so no.
Oh, okay. Well, is there a place where you can go to find out what the official hashtag is for something?
Unfortunately, not. Some of them are pretty obvious. Bill Cosby would be an obvious one. If you were tweeting about The Walking Dead, I would go to The Walking Dead's Twitter handle and see which one they're using. That's what I do for all of my clients when I tweet. It's pretty easy to figure out what it is. There's no such thing as an official hashtag unless like a TV show or a movie creates it. Even then, no, there's no database. Whoever develops it, though, is going to be rich.
I have to go. there's a little project that I have to get started.
I got it. Just keep going.
Okay. Just saying, people. Anyway, Karen, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us. And it's so good to hear your voice and to know that you're doing well.
For people who want to follow you on Twitter, where do they go?
I'm not that interesting on Twitter, ironically. Karen _Woodward.
And there's also KarenWoodward.com, right? No,
KarenWoodwardOnline.com.
I forgot. That's right.
Yeah, I think KarenWoodward.com is a writer who we're promoting right now. You could also, if you're a fan of cats, you can find me on Instagram at KWoody, KWOODY. All I do is Instagram my cats, though. Although I visited Facebook and Tumblr last week, so I included some stuff from that.
You're the one.
I was the one, yeah. Do I sign the Facebook wall at Facebook, which is, like, by the way, going to, like, the White House. You have to sign an NDA just to get in the door.
Very cool.
Well, thank you very much, and we'll post links to all of your work in the show notes.
Yeah, let me know when it's up, guys, and I'll promote it for whatever it's worth.
Thank
your
you very
cat
much.
Your will promote it.
Bye, guys.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Thanks a lot. Before we finish with Bill Cosby, I don't want to make light of the allegations, nor do I want to, you know, it's tricky. You know, when somebody makes an accusation, you don't want to just assume it's true. When somebody has 13 people lined up to testify in court about similar allegations, it's obviously very disturbing. That's all happened in 2006, but he has never been convicted of anything. He did settle out of court with a woman who claimed he sexually assaulted her. It's very upsetting. You never know how often you're supposed to keep repeating or talking about it, or how, you know, what are you supposed to do? Are you supposed to never watch him on TV again? I don't know what the right response is, but I know that you can look at this film called An Open Secret, which is a documentary movie that played at Doc NYC, which is a documentary film festival, which it deals in part with the person who made the allegations against Bryan Singer and the other people involved in that Hollywood internet startup called Den, and all the allegations of underage sex and rape and abuse that were going on around that. This film has a lot of people talking about it on screen, about their experiences in Hollywood with a lot of different people, casting directors and managers and agents and people. They do not have Corey Feldman on speaking to the film, but they do have clips of him talking. It's by Amy Berg, who's an Oscar-nominated director for a movie she made about child abuse in the Catholic Church. And this movie played at this film festival, and they've now admitted finally that it's probably the only time it will be seen. They're probably not going to get a distribution deal. And people say, look, people in Hollywood don't want this to get out. They don't want the story of the exploitation of minors to gain visibility. So I felt bad on the show about how we dealt with those allegations. You know, the guy who accused them ultimately has not been able to take it into court because it conflicts with earlier testimony he made. But, you know, we're not a court of law. One doesn't like to smear people just because an allegation is made. But at some point when there's so many, or that you're around people who are convicted of child molestation, then suddenly, you know, I don't know what to do. I hate even talking about this stuff. I don't know about you, but Bill Cosby, top film directors, you've got all this smoke. Sometimes there's fire.
Well, and I don't like, you know, covering it either.
We're not in the sense it shouldn't be covered. Like, we're not a legal website. It's not the tone of the show, but we don't like to ignore it either. And I never know when we should dive in and not dive in with all these various things that go on. So it's a hard line to walk, isn't it?
Yeah, indeed. As the Daily Mail found out, if you want to know what I'm talking about, search Bill Cosby Daily Mail.
Hey, did he successfully sue them?
No, but they basically took the woman's, I guess we'll talk about it, but they basically took the woman who is accusing Bill Cosby of rape, or at least one of them. And
which one, yeah.
Barbara Bauman, I think her name
is. Who had an op-ed posted on the Washington Post website,
and
yeah.
And they basically called Bill Cosby a rapist. They tried him right there in the story.
And what happened?
And they got a lot of flack for it.
Got a lot of flack?
Yes, on Twitter and places such as that. That basically, the way they wrote the piece was...
They didn't go through the basic alleged.
Correct.
Uh-huh. Well, I don't know if they got a lot of hits. I don't know whether they feel that they were punished if they didn't have to pay any money out. The Daily Mail is all about clicks.
That's so true.
I don't know whether they feel like they lost on that one, unfortunately.
Well, I think we lost last week with Glenn A. Larson passing away. He is the creator of Magnum P.I., Quincy and the $6 Million Man, BJ and the Bear, and Battlestar Galactica.
That's right. I mean, this was a big TV producer. His heyday was clearly in the 70s and the 80s. He started off early writing a script for It Takes a Thief, a fun TV show with Robert Wagner that I remember fondly. And within one season, he became like a top producer on that show. So he started from freelancing on a script to being in charge of the show. And then obviously had a lot of success creating and co-creating a bunch of different TV shows. We didn't even mention The Fall Guy, another Lee Majors TV series. But, you know, Battlestar Galactica didn't run a long time, but it was a big influential success in a lot of different ways. And of course, it spun off successful sequels. You know, he's had a fascinating career. He started in a singing group. He was in the Four Preps, which was a big vocal group. And they even kind of influenced the Beach Boys, among others. And he's one of the many people who has sued major studios. He sued Universal in 2011, saying they never sent him a single profit participation statement. Why did these people wait decades before suing? If you don't get a profit participation statement every year, for God's sakes, file a lawsuit. I guess when the money's flowing in, you just don't care. But these were big shows in my youth. What about you, Sperling?
Oh, they were huge. Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, they were hits, obviously, but like...
To give you some sense as to how big they were, many years ago, I was interviewing Lee Majors for... And it was a roundtable interview. It was done at the Roadhouse on Sunset Boulevard. It was, on the Sunset Strip. It was some Texas Roadhouse kind of, you know, themed restaurant. And they didn't have enough tables, so they sat us at... What I found out was the pool table.
Ah.
And so as I swung my legs underneath what I thought was a table and found out, no, there aren't. There's no place for legs or any other body part. I hit my knee really hard. I mean, it made a loud thunk and somebody said, oh, are you okay? I said, actually, I'm really hurt. And he said, very wryly said, well, we can rebuild you. We have we have the technology.
Oh, God.
And he just he said it so wryly and plainly. And I thought, oh, how very funny. That's actually like it was like, which, well, of course, comes from the $6 million man.
Yes, 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 of course. And Glenn Larson was known for making shows that ripped off. I mean, were in the spirit of hit films. BJ and the Bear was sort of like Smokey and the Bandit, kind of crossed with Every Which Way But Loose. Alias Smith and Jones, which was his first hit. That was like Butch casting the Sundance Kid. Battlestar Galactica, of course, was like Star Wars. In fact, the producers of Star Wars even sued him unsuccessfully. And his reaction to all those claims was, I think, pretty much, duh.
Yeah,
of course I made TV shows that were, you saw a hit, you make another show like it. Big deal.
Exactly.
So, you know, a classic TV fixture, you know, a guy who had a heyday for 10, 15 years. You know, he hadn't done a lot in the last 10 or 15 years, but he saw his shows coming back around. Remakes of The Bionic Woman, remakes of Battlestar Galactica. There's TV shows based on a lot of these properties that are in the works right now and will probably become movies or TV shows again in the future.
I can't wait to see the $6 million man movie.
It'll be the $6 billion man at that point, right?
Well, I just want to see if they use that line.
Of course they will. Why would they not?
We have the technology. Okay, well, certainly if it wasn't for technology, you wouldn't hear us every week because we come to you through the internet, and you can subscribe to us on iTunes, the Microsoft Marketplace, or on Stitcher, or wherever they give podcasts away for free. We're free, so feel free to subscribe, to rate and review the show in any one of those podcast aggregators. Links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find links to Karen Woodward's work, and I'd like to thank her for joining us today to talk about social media and the entertainment industry. That's where you'll find links to contact us. Dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. That's DIRT@showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find ways to follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. You can also call us, 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can follow us on Twitter, in fact, twitter.com/showbizsandbox. And again, all of this information, showbizsandbox.com. It's all on our website. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's something new and interesting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's Gone with the Wind is 238 minutes long. .com.
Oh, I thought for sure that was going to be a .gov or a .org. But, you know, if you have trouble finding any of Michael's writing and coverage of the entertainment industry there, try michaelgiltz.com or head on over to the Huffington Post. Some of my work and writing can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. And apparently I'm on Twitter, @Sperling. Look me up.
Hashtag cool guy.
Ooh, nice. Thank you. I should say we will be off next week.
So, oh, this is news to me. Yes. Why did you, you're supposed to tell me at the beginning of the show. What if
forgetting.
They don't make it to the end? You're such a jerk.
Ugh, I keep forgetting. I'm sorry. Hopefully you've made it this far.
Hopefully you follow Sperling on Twitter so you can see when he posts a note saying, by the way, we're not on this week.
That's right.
Is it because you're traveling for Thanksgiving, I assume?
Exactly.
So until 2 weeks.
That's right. Until 2 weeks from now. Play nice.